GoPros, but effectively GoPros in this sphere, and wired them all up together, like I said, so they could be time synchronized. And that's the camera they use for this, which is very interesting. Anyways, it allows for some 6 degree of freedom's movement, but still in a small bubble around the capture device. And again, you can see that in the demo video. Another quote, I think John pulled this one: our pipeline produces volumetric free viewpoint video that can be explored with 6 degrees of freedom within a spherical 70 centimeter diameter viewing volume. This allows you to move your head and change your perspective, peek behind objects, and enjoy a greater sense of depth through motion parallax.
Yeah, so the camera you were describing that you'll see in the video, it's like many sort of SIGGRAPH research type papers. It's one of the jankiest things you've ever seen. Picture just a big, clear plastic sphere with cameras stuck to the inside of it with tape.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what it is. It's not, you know, it's all through the magic of software. So that just, well, and the cameras are stuck, not at random, but like hand placed roughly equal. It's not like a precision type of thing. They're just kind of, I mean, I don't know how precisely they're put in there, but it looked pretty haphazard and pretty like DIY, right? And so what this gives you with, you know, a bunch of cameras and a plastic sphere and a lot of computers, which is the important part, is the ability to watch a video, and while the video is playing, you can change your perspective in the video. You can do the thing that we were talking about last time, where like if you have a video of a concert you want to, you know, if you stand up or you're watching it in a headset and you stand up on your couch while you're watching it, the camera that recorded the video of the concert does not stand up. The camera was on a tripod. It never moved. It never got any higher or any lower. It never moved to the left. It never moved to the right. It was on a tripod the whole time, right? You can't control that by you getting up with your headset, right? So you should just sit still, because then your movement will match the movement of the camera, which is no movement. You can turn your head because the camera captured a field that is 180 degrees, 360, or whatever. You can turn your head up and down, left and right, and that works fine, but you can't move. So this sort of light field capture thing lets you move your head and have that motion reflected in the video, as long as you move within a 70 centimeters viewing volume. So you can't move a lot, but you can move. And there are demo videos of this on the website. We'll put the links in the show notes. Go to the demo videos. It's just in a web page, and you can move your mouse around, essentially, to say, all right, I'm watching this video. If you don't move your mouse, it just looks like a video. But if you move your mouse, you can be like, now I can see more on the top of that workbench, or less if I go down, right? You can move around left, right, up and down in the video, not just turning your head like QuickTime VR or these things, but moving within the video. And part of the thing that is exciting about this paper is like, okay, the way they do that is essentially brute force it. Like they have, if you picture a series of concentric spheres, a little sphere, then a bigger one, then a bigger one, like a concentric spherical shells, right? That's what they're recording, and then when you move around, it's sort of moving you through those shells. But as you can imagine, that's just incredibly data intensive to do. So this paper is about how they figured out how to compress that down into, as Casey mentioned, a 1 gigabit video stream, by figuring out what parts they can throw away and how to efficiently store all of them. And that's the innovative part. Like, instead of just saying we need a giant supercomputer to do this, we can put this on a web page and you can move around in it and it looks okay and it doesn't like break up, or they don't, you know, you can look at the video, you can see what they're constructing the video out of, all the different pieces of the shells as you move around, but they do a really good job of blending them together. So it really looks like, I don't know how to describe it because there's not really any parallel. Like, it's, even in Vision Pro, there's not really any sort of like thing to compare it to, but like actually being there. If you were really there and you move and you like sat up or, you know, stood up or sat down, your perspective would change. And you can do that with these videos. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's like the Harry Potter things with the little animated. No, it's not even that. It's holographic, maybe. I don't know. They need to come up with a better marketing name for this. But this is what I was talking about with like the Bahamas thing. If they could do this and make it maybe a little bit bigger than a 70 centimeter diameter viewing volume, then you could walk around on the beach. And it would all be captured live video, and you're looking at a real thing. It's not a 3D rendered scene. It's just concentric spheres of live video from many different positions. Again, this is what I was getting at with last time with like the real estate things, where they put a camera in six different places in a room, put it in like 6 million places in the room. So now you can just walk into the room and look around. And again, different than making a 3D model of it, which is probably the much more efficient way to do this. But this would be all real video, right? somehow all real video. I'm not sure what the mechanics are, but it really is kind of like sci-fi fantasy stuff when I look at this. Even though it is a very, very limited tech demo with very janky hardware, I'm still very impressed by it.
Yeah, it is super cool. And then continuing on in a similar vein, Joseph Humphrey writes, one technology I find fascinating and that could shape the future VR capture, if VR sticks around long enough, is neural radiance fields. It's essentially a photogrammetry-based, I hope I got that right, method for capturing still 3D images of objects or entire environments. What's remarkable is its ability to render realistic perspectives from multiple angles, complete with accurate reflections and specular highlights. So this is NERF, which is representing scenes as neural, N-E, radiance, R, fields, F, for view synthesis. Again, we'll put a link in the show notes to a talk that was given by, among other people, Matthew Tansik. We present a method that achieves state-of-the-art results for synthesizing novel views of complex scenes by optimizing an underlying continuous volumetric scene function using a sparse set of input views. So I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I can tell you, having watched the video, what it appears to be is, let's take, I think it's a couple of stills. I don't recall if it was one or several, but one way or another, take one or more stills and be able to figure out, okay, what is the depth in this? Very much like, you know, the portrait videos on an iPhone. Anyway,
yeah, it definitely is. I think it is more than one picture, because the whole point is, like, the thing I just described where you can watch a video and view it from different perspectives, this is the photo version of that, where it's just one moment in time, but it's captured from different perspectives. And then when you look at it, you have the ability to look from different angles at your still image.
So continuing on from Joseph Humphrey, while it's not ready for video capture yet and the quality isn't perfect, Meta has created an impressive demo for the Quest. And there's a Meta Nerf demo for the Quest, which is called Meta Horizon Hyperspace Demo. The description is, this is a demo experience to showcase our vision for photorealism as a profound new way to feel like you're physically there. We created these digital replicas using mobile phone scanning and cloud-based processing. Scanning is not available to users today. So now returning back to Joseph, what excites me most is the potential to fully capture 3D scenes, including different perspectives, without the need for manual 3D modeling. If future research leads to viable quote-unquote video version of this, the possibilities could be incredible.
You should check out that Google link, because that's what they're doing. It's the video version of that, but the 2D version of it is much more well-established. Like, NERF stuff has been around for a while. Again, this is from a 2020 paper. If you have the sort of still image version of it, that works really well for, you know, to fool you into thinking it's a dynamic environment. You can do what they do in video games. It's just like, it's basically a bunch of still textures, but then you put like some video of rippling water on top of the water thing. So the things that you expect to be moving are moving, but you know, or even just like, if you look at the demos of here, you can be convinced like that this is video until you notice like none of the blades of grass are moving or whatever. So the Google thing is exciting because they're really trying to do it with video with very limited motion. And this NERF thing is exciting because I imagine this is the type of thing you could actually do on a phone. Take it, you know, wave your phone in front of a person. It takes 15 pictures. It reconstructs this. And now you have what appears to be a 3D image of the person.
Yeah, these video demos are incredibly impressive. All right, moving on from immersive video, let's talk about John's app and some feedback with regard to it or things adjacent to it.
Wait, are we talking about Storacusa, or are we talking about Forage Space?
You like Forage Space.
I like Forage Space.
The British person who pointed out that in UK English, those words don't rhyme.
Because they pronounce the O as an A. It's Forage Space or whatever. It's ridiculous.
Must be their Boston accent.
It's a hybrid accent. Anyway, all right, so I'll stick with Storacusa. I'm going to keep calling it Storacusa until you tell us another name.
I like Forage Space. I also like Storacusa, for the record, but I like Forage Space. I think that's great. And, you know, it's, they're the same people that can't understand when we say hover, which is bananas. So I don't really care what they have to say. Theirs is English traditional. We're English modern. Anyways, Dave Nanian, friend of the show, Dave Nanian. Dave Nanian writes, and this is with regard to SuperDuper's smart update and making clones. Dave writes, to be clear, smart update does not separate clones using clones on the file system. To be clear, smart update does not separate clones unless those clones change, which starts to separate them on the source as well. What we can't do is only change the diverged blocks. And also, I'm not worried about my support because I can offer solutions. I'm worried about things like migration, and again, that this is going to be run by those who are out of space, not those who want to optimize their drive storage.
Yeah, the thing about a smart update, like that's a good nuance about what I was describing last time. Like on the first clone with Super Duper, it will faithfully reproduce your clones. So if you have some drive that is essentially over-provisioned because you have, you know, many, many clones of a very large file, that if they all took up their individual space, it would overflow your drive. When you do that first erase and clone with Super Duper, it will faithfully reproduce that. But in subsequent clones, like do using Smart Update, which says, hey, just copy the stuff that's changed since last time. At that point, if one of the clones has changed and diverged on the source, it can diverge a little bit at a time based on how much has differed from the other ones. But during Smart Update, if it's diverged at all, you get an entire complete separate copy during the Smart Update. And that can cause you to slowly fill your quote-unquote equally sized drive with a series of Smart Updates. Of course, you can always fix this by doing an erase update, and that will restore all your clones, but that's just a fact of life. And in terms of the people oversubscribing their disks and having problems during migration, yeah, that's potentially a problem. Like I said, that could be a problem today because the Finder does the same thing when you duplicate files, and depending on how oversubscribed people are on their drives, they could already be in a situation where they can't migrate. I would hope that Apple would come up with a way to faithfully reproduce clones during the migration process. That would be very helpful. They certainly have the expertise, technology, and access to the innards of macOS to do that, but I also don't see that as something that is forthcoming. So make sure your drives are always big enough.
Peter Marks writes, all this talk of RAM doubler and disk doubler and ATP triggered a memory of a time in the 90s when someone released software that drastically sped up Finder copies. I was working at Apple at the time, and we were amazed. It turned out, this is such an amazing story. It turned out that the Finder was updating the progress bar so frequently that it slowed down the file copy. Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Still a modern thing. When early in my development of my app that I'm working on, I was testing the speed of, scanning for duplicates and stuff like that. And I, at first, tried the naive implementation of every time you've scanned another item, you know, convey that information in the UI. And scanning, especially on SSD, goes really, really fast, and probably faster than 60 frames per second. It was a lot of updates. I'm not sure if it was slowing things down, but I think it might have actually gotten faster when I throttled the UI updates, because it's probably not that big of a deal, especially since it's separate threads and I have a lot of cores and I had a thread dedicated just to updating the UI, but it's still kind of a waste. So yeah, updating the UI at faster than the refresh rate of the screen is usually not a good idea. And then back in the bad old days, I think it was just probably burning CPU because you didn't have multiple cores. And I think it was probably wasting a lot of CPU time, you know, updating the UI as fast as it possibly could. I think he might be referring to Speed Doubler, the thing I mentioned on the past show. I don't remember what Speed Doubler did. I only remember that I ran it and it did make things perceptibly faster. And maybe this was one of the things that it sped up file copies by updating the progress bar less frequently.
Then Harvey Simon writes, why should we care about how much free space we have if we've turned on desktop and document sync in iCloud Drive? If we run low on storage, older files are offloaded to iCloud, freeing up space locally, especially if one has, say, a desktop Mac with a large SSD and a MacBook with an only 256 gig SSD. Why worry if 256 gigs is sufficient if it looks like all one's files are where they belong and everything's backed up and you're online? I don't personally like, on paper, this makes sense, but I don't think I would trust Apple to do this and do this well personally.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like everything's there until you need that one file and you don't have an internet connection. And exactly. Also I will add that some cloud services, in my experience, iCloud Drive are not really great about doing the thing you want them to do right now, right now. I know they have pinning for iCloud now, finally, where you can say, please don't offload this file. I always want it to be local. But in situations, even when you have a network connection, you can be waiting for iCloud to take its sweet time to do something. I talked about my son's iCloud Drive disaster where he had so many files. You could just sit there staring at them for all day saying, when is it going to download the files that are in this folder? You can double click them and it would just sit there spinning and it's like, eventually it might do it, or maybe it never will because there's too many files. I'm not a fan of iCloud Drive. I've never been a fan. I continue not to be a fan. That big disaster with my son did not make me a fan. That's years after iCloud Drive has been out for a while. I know people have a lot of success with it, but I think they're using it lightly. They don't have lots of files. They don't have lots of churn. And it's just like, oh, it's magic. My files are just always there. In my experience, that is not how iCloud Drive works when pressed even a little bit. Dropbox, at the very least, has, like I said, one of the things I like about Dropbox is if you use it the old way, I'm still not using the one with the file providers, which I know everyone else is probably using, but somehow I'm still not updated to it. But the old one, when you launched it, it would brute force right now, with all its CPU cycles, download all the files locally. I'd had it not to do streaming, keep every file locally, like the old style, old school way. I could see it working. It would go through the files, find all the ones that have changed, download them all, and then be done. I was never staring at like a little cloud icon and list you in the Finder wondering, when is it going to download? Is there anything I can make it download faster? So, yeah. As for should we care about disk space, if you keep everything in like a Google Drive or OneDrive or something that you do trust that you think is reliable that you can actually get to upload and download files when you need them to, and you're always connected to the network, sure, feel free. But I think that for most people, they either don't have as reliable network access as that, or they don't have fast enough network access as that, is both, or both. And even if you do have all of that, I have very fast, very reliable network access in my house. Practically speaking, I don't want to have to wait around for something to download. If I want to, like, you know, we're doing our member special on Kiki's Delivery Service and I want to scrub through the movie, I don't want to have to wait for a multi-gigabyte movie to download. I just double-click it and move the scrubber and it should be as fast as my SSD can read it. And I don't have to worry about, oh, that file isn't there yet. How fast can you download a gigabyte? Because remember, it's not just your network connection. The server has to serve it to you at that speed. Your network connection can be as fast as you want, but if the server is doling the thing out to you at a slow data rate because it's overwhelmed with doing a bunch of other stuff or because the network connection between you and it is slow, you're still SOL. So, yeah, if you think local storage is still not relevant and you're leading that life, that's good for you, but I don't think we're there yet.
All right, let's talk some topics. And Marco, you had yet more homework. I feel like we've done maybe 3 out of 4 of the last episodes. You've had some sort of Vision Pro related homework, and here we are yet again with Vision Pro related homework. Apple, right after we recorded last week, released a new episode of their adventure series, and this one is called Ice Dive, and it's 15 minutes long. Its peers, off the top of my head, was the tightrope walker and then the parkour, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, were the two right. Others. And this one is Ice Dive, where we follow an ice diver that's trying to set a world record for swimming 200 yards, which is something like 180 meters underwater, with a fin on, but with one breath of air. And so he is swimming, hopefully, 200 yards, one breath of air under, under ice, in the water under ice.
So it's probably a little bit cold.
Yeah, it's very, very cold. He does a wetsuit on, but still. Anyways, it's like 15 minutes. And I wanted to not only alert some of you that this exists, but I also wanted to hear your thoughts. And I have some thoughts. Would you like me to start or would you like to start?
I think mine will be pretty quick. Okay. I didn't get all the way through it. I got about 8 minutes in, and I stopped because I was getting motion sick.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very surprising to me. Huh.
Yeah. So this series, I didn't see the middle one, the parkour one. I saw the tightrope walking one. I got about the same amount into that one before I had to stop. This series does a lot more camera movement and a lot more cuts between different scenes. And so what I find is, like, I'm trying to focus on things, and then all of a sudden, boom, we're cut away, and then, oh, now I'm flying over a mountain. It's like, whoa! So there's a lot more motion in this. And this series, too, they focus on very close-up shots of people and things. So similar to, like, the very first opening scene of the tightrope walking one, I described in the past how, like, you're like right in front of this woman's face, and to the point where you can like see her pores, and it looks a little unnerving. You're like, I would never be this close to a person I was not romantically involved with, in any other context in life. And so it kind of feels wrong to be that close to somebody and to have it look so lifelike. Well, they start this way, this one the same way with the swimmer guy. So again, it's like whoa, this is very intimate, a little bit oddly so, but. So they keep doing all these close-up shots of people and things, but I think they are doing the close-up shots with an assumption of sharpness that, as I was saying earlier, isn't actually there in the viewing experience. So what you get is really close-up people that look a little bit out of focus or a little bit blurry or a little bit soft. And so your eyes, it like plays tricks on your eyes in ways that the other immersive series I haven't had that much of a problem with. Because I think they just shot like a little bit further away from things with a little bit less camera movement. So this one, this series, I think is just, I can't, like my eyes and my motion brain, I think can't handle this series. But hey, I'm glad they're putting out more content.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, the pace of the new content has been really good. I'm bummed. Well, oh, sorry, I'm grading on a heavy curve there, but yeah. but nevertheless, to be clear,
you can still watch every single bit of immersive video on the Vision Pro the first night you take one home.
Yep, that's I think that is true, and certainly underscores chart from a few weeks back would probably lend credence to it. Anyways, I wanted to call this out partially, like I said, because it's new, but also I thought that this one was possibly my favorite of the. Like reality or not reality, but like docu series that Apple has done so far. I feel like it's a bit longer. My recollection is the parkour one was closer to 10-ish minutes and this is like a full 15 or so. And I've been thinking a lot about what do I think made this good? And I didn't get a chance to look and see if the director is the same or not, but she did a phenomenal job on this one. And I think part of what I really, really enjoyed about this was that the tightrope walking one just had the smell of it being completely staged. Like, you know, of course, at one point she's going to fall off the tightrope and of course she's tethered to it. So it's no big deal, but you still have that moment and whatnot. The parkour one was a little of that, but they tried to a degree to build a little bit of a story. And toward the end, spoiler alert, they're trying to do like a really big jump. And you're supposed to be stressed out about whether or not they're going to make the jump. And I mean, you are to a degree because you can look down where the camera is and see how high up they are. But it was kind of a contrived story. You know, it was clear that it was a story, but it was kind of forced. Whereas this one, there is a plot, and I'm using air quotes here, but there's a plot to it. There is a thing, a challenge that is going to be conquered if all goes according to plan. And there's consequences if it doesn't. And so you have a hero and the villain, I guess, to the degree that there is the situation, but there's a hero and you're watching a hero's journey, literally. And not only that, but I didn't have any motion sickness problems. And I thought that the way it was filmed was good. There's some, you know, annotations on the video showing how far away everything is and like where the start is and where the end is. And it's not overdone. It's in that Apple style that they're developing over these immersive videos that I like. I just thought it was really, really, really good, and I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was very captivating. And so here again, if you live near an Apple store, have a friend that has one of these, I presume they'll let you watch it if you want to, and I think it's worth your time. I thought it was pretty darn good. So check that out, Apple Adventure Ice Dive. John, thoughts on this?
I can't believe Marco's getting motion sick and you're not. I mean, neither one of you is particularly prone to it, but, you know, I feel like it's one of the limitations of this type of content. It's just, I'm not sure how you can get over that other than just not making content that moves around too much. Because it's really limiting from the recording perspective to try to do interesting things or show something dynamic. And again, the assumption is that, you know, the person who's watching it is not going to know how to move to match the movement of the camera, even if they could, which they probably can't because they're sitting on their couch. So there's always going to be this disconnect between what you see and what you're actually feeling as you sit there. So, yeah, I think this stuff is cool and I would like to watch it, but I definitely don't like to feel sick, so I'm torn.
Fair enough. No, I just think it's really cool. And again, if you have the ability to go check this out, I strongly encourage you to. Speaking earlier of Dave Nanian and Super Duper, there's been a bit of a brouhaha over bootable backups on macOS. And so to back up a little bit and set the stage, Super Duper, and I can't speak for a Carbon Copy Cloner, which is a competitive product to Super Duper. I've only ever used Super Duper. Anyway, Super Duper's thing, or one of its things, is that you can create a bootable backup of your drive and then update it, you know, every night, every other night, you know, however often you want to update it. But the key is that if you plug in this external drive and, you know, do whatever incantation and dance you need to do in order to tell your Mac to boot from it, it should be able to boot from it. And that's worked really, really well for a really, really, really long time. But then a week or so ago, or whenever, I guess, 15.2 came out, Dave had problems, and so Dave wrote a blog post, of which I will read some excerpts. macOS 15.2 was released with a surprise, a terrible, awful surprise. Apple broke the replicator, or ASR, Apple Software Restore. Toward the end of replicating the data volume, seemingly when it's about to copy either preboot or recovery, which is to say the system stuff, it fails with a resource busy error. In the past, resource busy could be worked around by ensuring the system was kept awake. But this new bug means on most systems, there's no fix. It just fails. Since Apple took away the ability for third parties, for example, the super duper folks, to copy the OS, it took on the responsibility themselves. It's been up to them to ensure this functionality continues to work. And in that, they failed in macOS 15.2. Because this is their code and we're forced to rely on it to copy the OS, OS copying will not work until they fix it. To put it bluntly, this sucks. It's bad enough we have to work around other bugs in this code, but when it breaks completely, we're stuck pointing fingers and offering workarounds that don't involve the replicator. Now, with that said, we had a response to a degree from Mike Bombich, who is the or a developer on Carbon Copy Cloner for macOS. And we took out some of the spicier hot takes in this blog post, but it was a spicy blog post. So it might be worth checking out if you're interested. Anyways, Mike writes, while some developers seem surprised by a change in macOS 15.2, there's a little bit of spice, we've known for several years that making bootable backups would eventually become impossible. We shifted Carbon Copy Cloner's strategy away from relying on external boots so our users wouldn't be affected by this inevitable result. Several years ago, I wrote a blog post about the macOS Big Sur changes that affected how third-party developers would be able to make copies of the system. In that blog post, I made reference to a conference call that I had with Apple on December 2nd, 2020. Participating in that conference call was the APFS team lead, someone from developer technical support, and to my surprise, Apple's director of product marketing. When I joined the call, I was prepared for a technical discussion of what was broken in the ASR and whether Apple would be able to fix those issues and make it reliable enough for a commercial backup solution. The call didn't quite go in that direction. The marketing director kicked off the call by asking, quote, "So how would it look if someday in the future you simply couldn't make a copy of the system at all?" He and the more technical folks on the call went on to explain that why only ASR could be allowed to copy the system and that they were committed to addressing any problems with it as long as it did not require making a compromise to platform security. Platform security is a top priority at Apple, and one of the keys to that security is a secure boot environment. Allowing system files to be copied introduces an opportunity for attackers to modify key system components. Some of this can be mitigated by only allowing Apple's ASR utility to make the copy, but there are still inherent opportunities to inject changes when copying system files. Apple has invested a lot of effort into the recovery mode environment and Migration Assistant. It has become trivial to boot a Mac into recovery mode, perform a clean, secure install of the system, verified and signed, and then recover user data via Migration Assistant. All of that can be done without compromising the security of the boot environment. Will Apple fix this issue so that bootable backups can limp along a little further? Maybe, but that's getting to be a moot question. Apple made it unambiguously clear that bootable backups and system cloning are fundamentally incompatible with platform security.
All right, so a couple of things here. To start, why do we care about bootable backups? Why do we use something like SuperDuper? Why is this a valuable thing to have? And most importantly, on Mike's post, why is recovery mode not a sufficient replacement? The magic of bootable backups is that if something goes wrong with your main drive, you can just reboot and be back up and running in the time it takes you to boot from your other drive. This was much more important in the days of spinning disks and also much more reliable in the days before Apple Silicon, because as we noted on a show a week or two ago, Apple Silicon Macs cannot really boot from external drives. They always essentially boot from the internal drive and then say, oh, I see you wanted to boot from an external drive, and essentially hand off control and continue to boot from there. But the secure boot environment is all contained within the hardware that Apple sells and is, you know, cryptographically as secure as it can be, knowing that it's booting off a known good system. And allowing that all to be bypassed by saying just trust whatever's on this drive is a, you know, a potential problem, right? That's the secure boot environment that Apple is defending. That's why Apple Silicon Macs work like they do. But what it also means is, unlike the old days, if your boot drive like dies, like, you know, is totally broken or is fried, or like just, you know, you're in the old days, your spinning hard drive, the heads crashed into the platters, like it's just dead. The old days, you're like, okay, I'll take this internal drive, rip it out of my computer, throw it in the garbage can, and boot from my super duper clone. And I'm up and running as of whenever the last backup was, which might have been last night, right? Just in the amount of time it takes to boot. I don't have to wait for a whole OS install, which can take a very long time. I don't have to do any of that stuff. I'm just up and running. And by the way, I just booted my Mac that has no hard drive in it. I booted it from an external drive. because that hard drive that was broken is now in the garbage can. If your Apple Silicon Mac, if the SSD goes bad, like totally dead on it, you cannot boot off an external drive. That Mac will not boot off anything because you need the internal SSD to at least have enough parts of it working to boot from the little part of the OS that's needed to go to external boot stuff. So that is different. But still, if you hosed yourself, accidentally deleted a bunch of files, broke some part of your user directory, you know, accidentally recursively deleted parts of your home library directory as root, your system could be entirely hosed, but your SSD still works. So you will be able to boot from an external backup, and that's where having a super duper bootable backup can get you up and running much faster. I mean, that whole, like, you know, as I develop this app that I'm working on, maybe I will accidentally host my, you know, host my directories, my files, in a way that didn't damage the SSD, but it renders my system entirely useless to me. It will be great to boot from my super duper backup in that scenario. So I think bootable backup still is very important, and recovery is absolutely not a substitute, because if anyone has ever done recovery mode, even though we have fast computers, fast internet connections, reinstalling macOS takes longer than you think it does. If you're in a hurry, or, you know, if you're trying, like, you might as well just write off the whole rest of the day to dealing with that sometimes, because it takes, you'll just be staring at indeterminate spinners for a long time, wondering how long it's going to take, how many more reboots is it going to take, how many more progress bars am I going to have to see. So I don't think that's a great solution. All right, given all of that, this whole discussion in 2020 with, is it Phil Schiller at the time? Is he director of product marketing?
I think that was already past the change.
Yeah, I don't know who it is, but anyway. So the quote, we know there's a quote or a paraphrase or whatever, it says, how would it look someday in the future if you simply couldn't make a copy of the system at all? The conclusions that Mike draws from this, that bootable backups are not a thing, and that Apple made it unambiguously clear that bootable backups and system cloning are fundamentally incompatible with platform security, I'm not sure I agree with that. So first of all, the statement is, this is an Apple person saying, how would it look someday in the future if you simply couldn't make a copy? If you, third-party developer, simply couldn't. That came to pass. Third-party developers can't make bootable copies. You have to run Apple's ASR tool to do it. Apple can make a bootable backup. You can't, which is why SuperDuper is in the bind it is, because they can't do it. They have to use Apple's, you know, privilege signed secure tool to do it. But I'm not, and the second thing is, I'm not saying this is not true, only that I have not been convinced that it's true by reading this post. The idea that if copies of system files can be made by anybody, including Apple, somehow this is a security issue. So saying, like, allowing system files to be copied introduces an opportunity for attackers to modify key system components. Some of this can be mitigated by only allowing ASR to make a copy, but there are still opportunities to inject changes. I don't understand how that could possibly be the case. The whole point is you cryptographically sign the whole thing with the sealed system volume or whatever, and those cryptographic keys are secured by keys that are in the hardware and verified over the internet and yada yada. Like, if you modify any part of the system, if a nefarious third party modified part of the operating system when copying it, like, that would be detected because the signatures wouldn't match. Like, and the secure boot environment, like the Apple Silicon Macs booting from their internal drive and making sure they have a secure boot environment, ensures that the thing doing the verification can't be tampered with, because that's the thing that kicks off the boot process on the external drive, and it can verify that the system volume is sealed correctly or whatever. Maybe I'm missing something here, but I think the conclusions being drawn here are, at least do not convince me that Apple thinks that making a bootable drive should not be possible, because that doesn't make any sense. You make a bootable drive all the time. You make a bootable drive when you install the OS. That is an example of Apple software making a bootable drive. It's no different when they're doing it to the one and only drive on your Mac or doing it to the second and you know, another drive on your Mac. It is still Apple software connecting to the internet and putting in an OS there. And yes, it put it by downloading off the internet, but it's no difference than it putting it by copying it from another location. In both cases, it has to verify that the OS is proper and signed and so on and so forth. So this is unfortunate. Like, ASR has broken before, by the way. SuperDuper has always been dealing with it. We've been in the age where only ASR can copy the operating system for a while now. And it's, as Dave says, it's broken in the past. And it's cruddy because you're a third party. You're like, look, I can't do it myself. I have to use this tool that Apple provides. And if the Apple provided tool has bugs or does weird things or just plain doesn't work, you just have to sit around and wait for Apple to fix it for you. I assume that's what will happen in this case. I assume Apple will fix it. Like I said, I am not personally convinced that Apple was trying to say that it is impossible to make a bootable version of make a drive that is able to boot macOS using Apple software, because it just doesn't make any sense to me. That's what the OS installation and recovery process do. I don't see how cloning is that different. Worst case scenario, you could say, okay, it won't copy the operating system from one drive to another. It will install a fresh one from the internet. But because the thing that you boot from is a read-only cryptographically signed snapshot, it's the same for everybody. It's a separate volume. It's not where your data is. There should be no difference between copying the operating system from one drive to another and putting a fresh version of that operating system by downloading it from the internet. The only place where there are questions here is like, okay, well, what if Apple is no longer signing that version of the operating system, or you can't get it because it's so old or whatever? In that case, a copy would work, but a download wouldn't. But I don't know. I think and hope that this is just yet another one of unfortunate bugs in macOS, because these parts of the OS are understaffed, and that they will eventually fix it, and Super Duper will start working again, and all will be, if not right with the world, then better. But I just, like, again, if someone can explain to me how what Mike Bombich is saying makes any kind of sense, please do. But right now, I feel like Apple was not trying to say that it will be impossible to make bootable versions of macOS, only that third-party developers wouldn't be able to do it themselves. Only Apple could do it. That's another thing that only Apple can do.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't have the faintest idea. I would hope that Apple provides a mechanism to do this and maintains it, but I don't know. We'll see what happens. We'll see how this shakes out.
Yeah, I kind of wish, like, so the promise of APFS and all of the new file system stuff they did is that this type of stuff could get better, and it did get better in many ways. Like, a lot of the parts of the system that deal with this, like Time Machine and stuff, like Time Machine will now, like, make a snapshot first and then copy that snapshot. Kind of, I'm assuming one of the benefits of that is that it helps with the painting the Golden Gate Bridge problem, where in the bad old days, Time Machine would start running and it would start copying files from your disk to your Time Machine backup. And in the beginning, it would copy, you know, a bunch of files or whatever. 2 hours pass and it's copying the last files. During that 2 hours, the files that it copied at the beginning could have changed. And so you're like, oh, well, when am I done? Do I have to go back to the beginning now because I noticed some new things changed? Oh, wait, now by the time I get to the end of that, there's still things that you keep going back and back. And now it just copies it once and says, okay, I'm done. You may end up writing an inconsistent view. Like, the source disk never looked like this at any moment in time. The beginning of the source disk looked like this, and by 2 hours later, the end of the source disk looked like this, but the thing that you wrote has files that you copied in the beginning look like they did an hour ago, and files that you copied at the end look like they do right now. Snapshots avoid that, because you can take a moment in time snapshot and say, here's a frozen snapshot of what this drive looked like at a given moment, and now I can take my time leisurely copying that snapshot, because that snapshot's never going to change. It is literally a moment in time snapshot. So even if it takes you 4 hours to copy that snapshot, the file you copy at the end is exactly from the exact same moment of time as the file you copied at the beginning. Stuff like that is great. One of the strategies Time Machine uses to figure out what has changed since my last backup, so I don't have to scan the entire disk again, one of the strategies is some kind of snapshot diffing thing. I really hoped that they would go whole hog ZFS thing. ZFS has the ability to send block level diffs between snapshots, where not only does it, you know exactly what changed in, I'm not sure if it's constant time, but, or it might just be linear, but anyway, an efficient way to tell exactly what changed, it does it at the block level, not at the file level. So it doesn't, if a file changes, it's not like copying whole files. It says, I know this block from this file changed and these two blocks from this file changed, and can efficiently transfer just those blocks to another thing, but there's lots of limitations to doing that in ZFS. Anyway, I was hoping that kind of technology would come to macOS, and they've sort of kind of got a little bit of it, but not really. And, you know, cloning is a whole other thing. But anyway, it would be great if they continued to advance their file system APIs and support for this type of thing to do efficient, essentially what Super Duper does, efficient copies, like that smart update. Only copy the things that changed over here, And yes, to also be able to make bootable, efficient clone, copy, backup things. Like, I'm not saying put Super Duper out of business, but I'm kind of saying, like, eventually technology gets to the point where what was once a thing that only a third party could do because it was so not supported by the operating system eventually should become something that is so easily supported by the operating system, kind of like what I'm doing. My app is doing stuff that is so easily supported by the operating system. I'm just providing like a fancy wrapper on top of it. I would hope that's where Super Duper would get eventually. Building on ASR to say, okay, well, we can't do it, we have to use Apple's tool, it seems like it's going in that direction, except ASR is so much less capable than the code that Super Duper, when it was doing it itself, because ASR is just like, well, I've just got one job. I'm called Apple Software Restore. I'm not called be the underlying engine for Super Duper. So it is so limited and so brute force and so not what Super Duper would want. But, you know, maybe someday, like, it took us so long to get APFS and we got lots of benefits from it. But I still think we're a long way from really realizing all of the benefits of modern file systems to make stuff like this so much better. And you know, again, I appreciate the time machine snapshots, local snapshots, where you can do essentially time machine backups without having your time machine drive attached, so you can go back in time to something from 10 minutes ago because a local time machine backup was taken. That's all well and good, but time machine itself still feels like kind of abandoned and lonely and filled with bugs. And yeah, ASR being the one and only tool that can copy a bootable version of the operating system from one disk to another, it doesn't seem tenable to me. And as for only being able to boot off internal drive on Apple Silicon, I don't know what the solution to that is, because I do understand this. I do understand why they do that. Like, that's the security implications of not allowing that make sense to me, but it is very limiting when it comes to the ability to recover quickly from a disaster. It kind of makes the most workable solution for that to essentially have a second Mac. Right. So, yeah, have two Macs that are both as up to date as they can. Start your project. And if this Mac fails, I need to be able to continue work immediately. Just throw that whole Mac away, slide in the new Mac, and just try to pick up where you left off. If Apple's cloud syncing was better than it actually is, you could probably do that. But as it stands, you're probably starting work from wherever you were at the beginning of the day.
All right. Hello, future Marco. I personally think we should quit it here, move to Ask ATP, because I think overtime is going to be long. Yeah. So, all right. Goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
Oh, we have no, wait. That, well, first of all, that's up to you to, oh, no, wait. Ask we're doing ATP. Ask ATP. I'm an idiot. God bless. Man.
Someone just mentioned that. I don't know who it was, though.
God. Yeah, bootleg. I swear. You're getting what you're paying for. All right. Let me try this again. I am with it. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. Ciro Mazzola writes, with the Mac's latest operating system update, Sequoia 15.2, Apple's created a new folder for recording your history. It's called Recents. It's an option in the Finder sidebar. How does this fit in with Apple's policy of privacy? Is this really new? I swear this is not new, but maybe it is. I think I might be missing the point here. Why is this not privacy friendly?
So this is, all right. So I think what Ciro is saying is, like, if this is in the sidebar, and if you see it in the sidebar and you click on it, you may be shocked to see, there's all the files that I've messed with recently. And it's sort of like a trail of your activity. And if you thought you were secretly messing with some files somewhere and you have a document that says my master plan to take over the world.txt, and suddenly when someone clicks on something in your sidebar, they see that file and your plans have been revealed. What that recent thing is doing is the same thing you can do if you hit Command F in the Finder and you search for files recently opened within the last 30 days, which is a thing that you can do that you've been able to do for decades on macOS. It's just a saved search, finding files that have been opened recently or whatever the thing is. Let me put up in the Finder to see the exact thing. I think it is last opened date. Last open date is within the last 30 days. You've always been able to run that search. Now, it's more accessible as a sidebar item in the Finder than having to hit Command F, pick one item from a pop-up menu, type 30, and hit return. But practically speaking, this is not a privacy-invading feature. This is just part of a fact of life. If someone else has access to your computer, logged in as you, they can hit Command F and find files based on any criteria they want. They can find image files, last opened within the last 30 days that are JPEGs that are larger than this size. Like, and they can save that as a save search in a smart folder that looks like a little folder icon, but when you double click it, it opens a folder. But the contents of that folder are the contents of a save search. This whole idea was something I really liked back in the days of like BOS, where their file system had native support for this with like indexing in the file system and really fast searches. macOS still supports it. Some people get a lot of use out of it. I think its implementation is a little bit janky, and its integration in the Finder is not great. So many people don't even know it exists, such that when they put something called recent files in the sidebar, they're like, oh, privacy invasion. Where did this come from? It's a new feature in 15.2. I kind of see the point, but just FYI, this has always been there. It's kind of like realizing that your web browser is keeping track of your browser history if you're not running in incognito mode all the time. You can just go, and there's a menu item that shows history, and you'll scroll. This is every web page I've been to. It's watching my every move. I mean, and, you know, Google Chrome is probably reporting it back to Google as well. But that's how computers work to some degree. If you don't like it, there's not much of a solution. Some things in, like, macOS, like within individual applications, if you go to the file menu, there'll be an open submenu with like recent items. You can clear that recent items menu, which is, it used to be just like a plist somewhere. I don't know where they're storing it these days. But anyway, sometimes you can clear the recent items to clear the last things that you've opened. But practically speaking, if it's file system metadata, the find command can search based on it and return results. You could wipe that metadata if you wanted. Every file that you last opened, go through it and wipe the metadata, or duplicate that file and delete the original, or like there's all sorts of stuff you could do. But like, what are you trying to do here? Really, if you don't want people knowing this about your computer, don't let them access to your computer logged in as you. That's the solution.
Tucker writes, what is the quote unquote correct directory location to save random Python shell, Ruby, Perl, PHP, etc. scripts to keep them organized and easily accessible, executable? I use the Fish shell, and I typically write my scripts of that sort using Fish, and so there's a particular folder that you're supposed to put them in, and then occasionally if I write other stuff, I'll just put it in my home folder because I have very little in my home folder. I'm sure this is going to make John roll over in his not grave but grave. So before John tells us all what we're supposed to be doing, Marco, what is your approach
For this kind of like, you know, random scripts and stuff for my local Mac to run? So obviously, like, there's scripts that are involved in apps I make, like Overcast. Those just go in the Overcast web source root, so that's kind of separate. But for just like kind of random other scripts and stuff that I run just for my Mac locally, I actually have a folder in Dropbox for those. And part of my new Mac setup is to add to my, well, first install Bash, and then add to my Bash profile to include a Bash profile file that is in this Dropbox folder, and then that does everything else for me. So that way, when I set up a new Mac, or, you know, managing between my desktop and laptop, I don't need to like constantly be shuttling things back and forth manually or resetting things up. Any of that stuff just lives in Dropbox, and including most of my Bash profile, which again is just included by the actual local Bash profile. It includes the Dropbox Bash profile, and that sets everything else up. That's where all of my aliases are, and all sorts of stuff like that. So I suggest, you know, keep it in, you know, whether you use Dropbox or, you know, whatever other file sync provider you use, keep it in there, unless you have some really good reason not to.
All right, John, what are we supposed to be doing?
So there is a correct, with the scare quotes like this question says, a correct directory for saving executable scripts from a cultural perspective for everybody my age and older who cut their teeth on Unix in either the late 80s or early 90s. And that answer is /bin, B-I-N, lowercase. You make a directory called bin in your home directory. You put all your executable files there. You add your, you know, /bin to your path. And on every system you do that, and whatever things you want to be executable, you put in there. That's mostly just a cultural answer, and it's based on the fact that if you were on a multi-user Unix system back in those days, probably at your university or whatever, you didn't have access to the system-wide directories. So you had to pick some other directory to put things, but you did have access to your home directory, but you'd want the directories in your home directory to be structured like the system-wide ones, and so you know, the ls command is bin ls, and your customized version of the ls command would be /bin ls. I, in fact, do have a bin directory in my home directory. I make it invisible so it doesn't show up in the Mac side of things with just the hidden attribute, but it is, in fact, there. It is in my path. That is the correct location for files that you want to be in your home directory. Now, If you just want to say stuff that you just want to be able to run, the other correct location on your own Mac, where unlike in university, you do have access to the system-wide files, is user local bin, and that's USR, not USER, and it's all lowercase. All lowercase slash USR slash local slash bin. User local, Apple has essentially pledged, Europa in 2010, attempt no landing there. All these worlds are yours except user local. They said they won't mess with user local. They're not going to put their stuff there. They're not going to accidentally wipe it during an OS update. That was a promise statement from many, many years ago. So far, it has still been true. If you would like to put system-wide stuff somewhere for yourself manually, user local, user local bin, user local include, user local man, user local lib, user local share. Everything in user local is yours. And what do you put there? The same directories that are at the top level, a bin, a lib, a share, an include, anything you want, you put there. So user local bin is where I put the executables that I want to be generally available to everybody on the system. And my path also includes user local bin, which is another common thing to have in your shell path on a Unix system. So those are the answers, bin and user local bin for executables. As for keeping them organized, that's different than keeping them easily executable. You might want to organize them by category and make subfolders, but now you're adding even more files to your path, and maybe you could have symlinks up to the top level, put them down to other things, and if you're using a package manager, all your crap is at opt, and it's messing with your path, and you're using RVM and NVM and all these virtual environments to point to different versions of Node and different versions of Ruby and different versions of Python, and there's a whole web of symlinks, and just, I don't like that. it rubs me the wrong way. But it is how a lot of the world works. And speaking of fish, every single one of these freaking things assumes, of course, you're running ZSH bash or fish or some other POSIX compliant shell. So it's no problem. If you want to use NVM, just type .nvm.sh and you're up and running. Oh, but you're not running ZSH or bash or sh or fish, are you? Oh, well, tough luck, because you can't source that file because it's written in a shell that your thing doesn't support. So I guess you just can't use our thing. Oh, well. There's no other shells in the world except for bash, CSH, and fish, as we all know, so that will never come up. Guess which shell I use? Not one of those three.
What do you use?
So that I'm used TCSH, because I'm old, and that was on my first Unix system, and someday I'll be forced to change probably to ZSH or bash or something else. I probably won't change to fish. A little too weird for me. But yeah, a lot of those systems just assume they know what shell you're using, and nothing works. You can't use the node installed by NVM until you source the NVM thing, or unless you port it to TCSH or figure out how it's manipulating your path to do what it's supposed to do. This is why I compile everything from source and install it under user local. It comes with me across OS updates. It's always where I want it to be. It's not a web of symlinks, and everything works fine. I think that is a reasonable organization, but I'm an old Unix person, and I don't like these newfangled things, and I don't use Homebrew, and I don't use any kind of package manager, and I kind of wish Apple would write a package manager for macOS that was natively supported, but so far they haven't.
All right. John had opinions. Who knew?
Shocked. And
finally, Saul Sutherland writes, do you keep the internet firewall enabled on your Mac? It comes off by default on new installs, but I make it a habit to enable it to protect myself from incoming connections on coffee shop Wi-Fi and when my Mac is connected directly to the internet for testing at work. For me, I don't turn it on. I don't think I ever have. I'm not that concerned about incoming connections. I mean, I could make an argument why one should and could be, but I don't know. I'm not that worried about it, and no, I leave it off. And when I'm on coffee shop Wi-Fi, I use Tailscale's, not a sponsor of this episode, but obviously I'm in love with them. Tailscale's exit node functionality basically says, take all of your outbound traffic anyway and route it through something else. And I route it through my house. So for me, no, don't use it. Because I think John will have most opinions. Let's start with Marco. Marco, do you use the internet firewall?
No, I think most software these days is designed to assume any network you're on is hostile. And to not grant, unreasonably open access to others on your network without your permission. So I don't think it's super necessary for most people to worry about that. But if you have that kind of extremely high security need for the networks you're on, then you might have different priorities. But I think for most people, you don't have to.
Yeah, John.
as someone who essentially never does a clean install and has just simply been migrating from one Mac to the next and installing new versions of macOS on top of the old ones since 1984, it's sometimes a mystery to me what my settings actually are, because the last time I looked at them may have been a decade or more in the past. So I had to actually go to system settings to see, do I have the firewall enabled? And this would have been something that I set back in the macOS 10 days, right? Because it didn't exist in classic macOS. The answer, to my surprise, because I thought I had it turned off, is yes, I do have it active. Why? Maybe it was the default a long time ago. Maybe it's currently the default, but I have it active and it has never affected my life, so I'm inclined to keep it that way. I don't think about it actively. In general, I agree that like most sort of network security happens outside the realm of your computer. I'm a desktop guy, so I'm not going to coffee shops with laptops. But my advice for firewall is, if it's not on by default on a new Mac, which I don't know the answer of, if it's not on by default, try turning it on and see if it annoys you. If it doesn't annoy you, leave it on. It's providing some additional measure of protection. If it starts annoying you too much, then you can figure out, is there a way I can keep this on and have it be less annoying? And if you can't figure it out, then just turn it off. But I would advise the default being turn it on and leave it on until or unless there's some reason not to.
You want to do one more since it's about Christmas cameras, basically?
Sure.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Torstein writes, is Marco still using his XT5 or did he go back to his iPhone again like he predicted he would? Also, what are the rest of y'all using these days going into the holiday season? iPhones or cameras? I guess since Marco was quoted in this one or named in this, why don't you start, Marco, and then I'll continue after you.
Yeah, so my Fuji XT5 remains my most commonly used standalone camera that's not an iPhone. I believe I've mentioned a couple times in the past, I did really bite the Fuji bug or get bitten by the Fuji bug hard. And last year, around the Black Friday season, I picked up on great sale their giant medium format GFX 100S. It has since been succeeded by the GFX 100S2. I have the first one. And so whenever I'm willing to carry around a very big camera, I bring the GFX 100S, and it is ridiculous. And I only have I only have two primes for it. I have the 100 millimeter portrait one, or the 90, I think it's 100, 110, that one, 110 millimeter portrait, and the relatively little pancake lens for it, which is the size of a grapefruit, the 50 or 45, 55 millimeter one. Anyway, I keep that 50-ish millimeter one on most of the time. That is my like landscape everything camera. But because it is so big and heavy, I more often have the Fuji with me. Like if I'm going somewhere with a backpack, I will often have the XT5 with me, is what I mean. And on that, I have the little tiny prime lens, or little tiny pancake prime for that. The 27 millimeter, which converts to like a 45-ish, something like that. I love that combo. It's a fantastic camera. The XT5, even though it is not technically as amazing as the GFX 100S, I greatly prefer its controls. I think it is my favorite camera I have ever used in terms of handling and controls and capabilities, because it has tons of manual control dials. And so I'm able, especially when I have a lens, which most of my lenses do, where the lens has an aperture ring on it, then I have physical controls for all of the main things. You know, I have shutter speed, ISO, aperture, and exposure. All of those, there's rings for if your lens has an aperture ring on it. So I just love the XT5 because everything is just clear and obvious. You can tell what all the important settings are just by looking at the top of the camera, and that's how I like to shoot. It handles the way I want a camera to handle. Things are laid out in a great way, which is not what I can say about the GFX, but the GFX wins on tech detail. But anyway, the XT5 I absolutely love. So to answer the question, whether I'm still using it or whether I went back to my iPhone, I never stopped using my iPhone to take pictures. Now I just, when I have the ability to have a big camera with me, I do take pictures with the XT5, and I really enjoyed it. And in fact, today I was going on a sunny winter day walk at the beach. I was running some errands over there, and I decided I'm going to go for a walk. And I brought the X-T5, and I took some pictures around the beach of the snowy town, and it was delightful. So I do use the X-T5 as often as I've used any other big camera in the last 15 years, which is not incredibly often, but I'm glad I have it when I want it. Christmas, I'm going to be using both of those heavily. Our Christmas setup is kind of a multi-camera setup usually. It's a big family ordeal, and there's different cameras for different purposes. So I will have the GFX with me with that prime lens on it, especially when light gets low. But for other times of the day, I'll be using the X-T5 with a more versatile zoom lens on it. So the answer is yes, I use it, and it's great.
For me, I have a Olympus Micro Four Thirds camera, which is why I was my interest was piqued earlier with that that immersive camera. I don't remember what generation it is, to be completely honest with you, but I use an Olympus OMD EM10. I want to say it's a Mark III, but I'm not 100% sure. The Mark IV appears to be the latest and greatest. That camera, while I love it and to my eyes takes incredible pictures, I've come to the conclusion over the last several years, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago now, that if I'm indoors, unless I have a lot of light, then the iPhone is likely to do a better job taking a photo than this is. Obviously, the bokeh won't be nearly as good from the iPhone. In fact, it will either be synthetic or not great. But in general, I find that particularly indoors, the iPhone does better. And then outdoors, it depends on what I'm up to, because the Olympus doesn't have automatic, or my Olympus doesn't have automatic like HDR or anything like that. And so I will choose between having subjects that are, exposed properly in a washed out sky or vice versa. And so I do still use the Olympus, particularly when I want a zoom, because I have some flavor of zoom lens that I forget off the top of my head on it, which is, again, less relevant now with the iPhone's 5X camera. Or if I'm outdoors, for sure. If I'm outdoors trying to capture like people or whatever, I am 100% reaching for the Olympus. But that's about it. If I'm not outdoors in decent light, then oftentimes it's just less fuss to use the iPhone. And that's typically what I'm doing. John, I need you to keep this to under 3 hours. Which one of your 17 cameras are you using? What scenarios, please?
So for the holidays, really for everything except for Long Island beach photography, I use my phone, obviously, and also what I consider my main camera, which is the Sony a7 III that Marco generously gifted me all those years ago. Love it. Still getting great mileage out of it. The lens I use on it is what I consider my sort of everyday lens. It's the most versatile single lens I have for this camera. It's the Sony 24-70 f2.8 GM2. What I like about the lens is the zoom range is reasonable. The aperture at 2.8 is reasonable, and the size is reasonable. You can get lenses with longer ranges and with a wider aperture. They're all bigger and heavier. This one is already kind of at the limit of big and heaviness, but it is versatile enough that I can use it in any kind of indoor or outdoor scenario where I'm going to be taking pictures of people at an event or doing a thing. So Christmas morning is that camera, and occasionally the phone, which I will take out for, I don't do any video on my big camera. I do video only on the phone. And occasionally I'll take out my phone to do video and then snap some shots with it as well, depending on how quickly I need to get the shot. Is the camera around my neck? My family complains that all the pictures of me at Christmas morning, I have a camera around my neck. With, like, someone's got to take the pictures and it's going to be me. So any picture they take of me with their phones, which they're terrible quality phones, is me with a camera around their neck. So that's my plan for this year as well. Same lens, same camera. It'll be around my neck while opening presents. I'm going to be taking pictures of everybody else, and they're going to end up going in the calendar that hangs in the fridge, and it's just the way it works, plus my iPhone pictures. My iPhone pictures get better every year every 2 years, my iPhone pictures get better because I get a better phone, and that trend continues. But it's going to be a little while before I ever upgrade the big camera. There are obviously many better cameras, but like me with my TVs, I'm waiting for that right better camera. Well, first of all, a better camera is going to cost me a whole bunch of money. So, you know, and I'm looking at the Sony cameras because I want to be able to reuse all my lenses, and I like Sony cameras. And so I'm just waiting for that right one. Like the A7 R5 was actually a really good one, but I don't know if I want the R series with that much extra resolution. I'm not sure if I want or need that to make my photos bigger. The A1 was tempting, but super expensive. The new version of the A1, it's like, oh, it's better, but they didn't change the sensor. Then there's the A9 with the electronic sensor. And it's like, maybe I should just wait until they basically have something with the dynamic range of the A1 series, but with the instant readout. I forget what the name of it is, but like the electronic shutter instant readout thing of the A9. And that is a technology that doesn't exist yet. So I'm just sitting here waiting. I'm saying, in the meantime, I love my A7 III, take tons of pictures with it. I have lots of different interesting lenses for it that I use in occasions when I have time to prepare. But my everyday lens, the Sony 24-70 GM2, highly recommended lens, great compromise between image quality, weight, and aperture if you have to pick one single lens to use for anything. And when I take, you know, sometimes like my kids are going to like a dance at school or something like that, like where I know I'm going to be taking pictures of people like all dressed up in their nice outfits, I'll put on one of my prime lenses to get better pictures out of it. But most of the time, the everyday lens gets me through.
All right. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. We are sponsored this episode entirely by you, members. You can join being a member at atv.fm/join. One of the member perks is a weekly bonus topic. Now, this week, we're going to do something special. This is for ATP Overtime, our bonus. It's the name of our bonus topic. Doing great. You know what? I'm going to start this whole thing over again.
All right, Casey. There
Hi,
we are.
Pass, Casey. All right. It's opposite day. All right.
Right.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We were sponsored. Well, I guess.
You're overthinking it now.
Right, yeah. Now you're over there. Now you're trapped.
All right. Thank you to our sponsor this week, the members. Thank you so much, members. You mean a lot to us, especially, you know, now we're getting all sentimental about holidays and everything. Thank you very much. You really mean a lot to us. If you want to join and be a member, one of the perks of membership is ATP Overtime. This week in Overtime, we're going to go through a wonderful idea John had. We're going to name, each of us is going to name our best tech thing of 2024, our worst tech thing of 2024, and the tech thing we are most looking forward to in 2025. If you want to hear that and every other thing we do in Overtime every week and all of our other bonus content and all the other benefits of being a member, you can join us at atp.fm/join. Thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
So I thought maybe we could take the opportunity to do like a quick catch-up on Aaron's car. If you recall, in June, when we were all at WWDC together, Aaron's old Volvo had a catastrophic engine failure. I forget which episode we talked about it, but you should go and listen to it.
Caused by
it. It is
a very small pebble.
How Correct. Are you not going to say, like, I was just waiting for you to get to that point. You're just going to say, oh, it had a catastrophic engine failure anyway, continuing on. It's like, no. It had a catastrophic engine failure caused by a pebble. It had a encounter with a pebble. It was defeated by a pebble. It was destroyed by a pebble. There's so many different ways you could do this. The important part is the pebble.
It was possibly the most interesting catastrophic engine failure I've ever heard.
Yeah, see, there you go. So anyway, you can hear the details on a prior episode. I don't recall which one, but that was in June. And then in early July, we figured out that we really just wanted to stick with Volvo. And I don't need to hear any feedback as to whether or not that was smart. Don't care. That's what we did. It's already done. And what we did this time, though, was, you know, Aaron had a Volvo XC90. It was a 2017. We bought a 2024. We leased, actually, a 2024 XC90. But this one is a plug-in hybrid, an XC90 T8. And basically what that means is it has a turbocharged four-cylinder engine, and it also has a battery electric engine, if your motor, I guess, strictly speaking, if you will. And anyway, so it gets about 30 to 35 miles of range, generally speaking. We can charge it in about 5 hours from dead here at home, because we have a like American dryer style plug, which is a 220-volt plug. I want to say it's like 50 amps, something like that, which then gets converted down to, I think it's a 30 amp, which is all that the car wants because it's not a huge battery. I believe it's 18 kilowatts, excuse me. Something like that. Anyway, you can tell it. No, see, there we go. I screwed it up. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about what it's like for someone to have a plug-in hybrid car. And I got to tell you, for our particular needs, and our particular needs are relatively unique, but for us, I freaking love this thing. And I think it was the perfect solution for our family. So generally speaking, Aaron drives 10 miles in a day, maybe 20 at most on an average day. And I just told you that the battery lasts roughly 30 miles, give or take a little bit, generally speaking. So that means that almost all of her driving she can do on electricity. And that also means that we bought the car, I want to say it was like July 10 or thereabouts. I forget exactly what day it was, but it was in the top half of July. A couple of weeks ago, we put our second tank of gas in the car.
How much horsepower is the electric motor?
You know, I honestly don't know. I want to say it's like 100 horsepower, but I really, truly don't remember off the top of my head. It's
so
not...
I'm wondering, like, if you're like forcing it into EV-only mode, essentially you get in, you put it into the mode that says don't use the gas engine at all.
There is that does exist. It's called Pure. And I have done that a handful of times. And oftentimes if I do it, it's because I want to allow myself the full depth of the accelerator pedal. You know how in like an automatic, you can just kind of feel, not physically feel, but you just kind of feel out that, oh, if I go any further, the car will downshift. And you know that unless you're really trying to, you know, get going somewhere, you can just that say 50% depth on the accelerator is all you've really got at that particular moment. Well, the same sort of thing is true here. Now, it is an automatic when it's using the gasoline engine, but that's not what I'm talking about. What I mean is you can just kind of tell that if I go beyond this depth of the pedal, it's going to kick on the gas motor. Not only that, but the tachometer, it's the power meter, strictly speaking, it has a droplet. I'm not sure why it's a droplet, but it's a droplet in a line that indicates, okay, if you ask for any power beyond this point, I'm kicking on the gasoline. And so we run it in hybrid mode 99% of the time, and it is exceedingly rare that it will turn on the gasoline for just getting around town purposes. Now, if we're on an interstate or something like that, it will absolutely kick the gasoline on from time to time. And then also I found that if you use the onboard navigation, and this has Android Automotive, which means it's the Google powered thing. It has Google Maps and whatnot. If you tell the car the destination rather than using like Apple Maps on CarPlay, it will do some sort of computational magic such that it will kick on the gasoline when there's plenty of battery power left. I believe because it thinks, okay, later in the trip, when you're close to your destination, you're going to want the juice for then. That being said, I'm not sure I really agree with some of its choices. Like it would use battery at times where I thought the gasoline might have served it better, like say on the interstate, and it used gasoline when I thought the battery might have served it better, like around town. Maybe it's right, and certainly it's presumably smarter than me, but I don't know, it just felt weird. But that was many words to say, no, we don't typically put it in pure mode. We typically run it in hybrid mode.
I'm surprised that your gas tank's lasting that long, then, because like you're essentially not you're not disallowing the gas engine from turning on, so it turns on whenever it feels like it. Although it does sound like you're kind of babying it because you don't want the gas engine to turn on, but still, it's turning on in your daily use. But I guess just a little bit, just briefly, and not enough to go through. Does it have a big gas tank? How big is the gas tank?
You know, that's a great question, which I also don't know off the top of my head.
You only filled it up twice.
Yeah, I've only filled it twice. Let me see if I can quickly find the... I log our fuel in a spreadsheet, a number spreadsheet. I don't know why I do it. I just like doing it. I have no good justification for it. But the last time...
Even less so now.
Yeah, right? The last time we filled it up, it was pretty darn near empty, and we put in almost 16 gallons, like just a shade shy of 16 gallons. And that was an effective miles per gallon on that tank of 77.2. That is by taking the amount of miles driven, you know, divided by the amount of gallons burned. But again, that's not really fair because most of that time we were running on electricity rather than gasoline.
That's one of the things that always worries me about hybrids. And we're so worried about Marco's i3's range extender is like, if you don't ever use the gas engine, A, you're just, you know, wasting electricity hauling this big heavy thing
around.
That
is true. Yeah, yeah.
And B, if you don't run a gasoline engine for long periods of time, it gets cranky. Like you do have to occasionally start it. And you are like it's clearly turning on. And although the auto stop start also makes me have empathy for the engine. I know they're designed to auto stop start. I know all the things they did to change the engine so they can do that and more robust starters and yada, yada. It's still not good for the engine still. Right.
Concur.
So I do worry that, I mean, you're just leasing it, so who cares? But like, as one of the strange compromises about hybrids is, you know, depending on how you use them, in like the quote unquote best case scenario where you're basically on EV almost all the time, A, it's inefficient to lug the engine around, and B, that engine is having a sad, difficult life that's probably not being run enough. It wants to be run. It's like, a thoroughbred horse. It wants to get out there and run, and you're just like, nope, electric motor's got it.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say that it probably, if I were to wager a guess, in the 6 months or thereabouts that we've had the car, I would say the gasoline motor has been on 10 hours or less, maybe. Like, it is very rare for the gasoline motor to run.
That's not a good healthy life for a gas engine. I know, who cares about, the whole point is you don't want to be burning gasoline. Like, I get that, but it's like, it just, that's why I always feel like a pure EV is so much more of a simple solution. But, you know, hey, live and learn.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I can't find any particular, you know, beef that I have with anything you just said. I agree with you. So far, you know, 6 months in, it has been incredible because we almost never use gasoline. And again, it's been a couple of thousand miles. Shoot, I already closed the numbers document. I think we were at, like, at the time of the last fueling, we were at 3,000 miles at the time we last fueled it. 3,000 miles. And we have put in a sum total of 26 gallons of gas, which is just bananas. And for our uses, it is the best of both worlds, because easily 90%+ of the time, Aaron is using it just on electricity. And then the handful of times that we want to go further, now, admittedly, we haven't taken it on a proper trip yet. You know, when I say further, I'm saying like a sum total of 100, 150 miles, which I know most reasonable EVs would laugh at. But that being said, anytime we want to take it further than the, like 30 or so, then the gasoline just kicks on and it's no problem. And that's worked out super duper well. And I think our family could have a EX90, which is the full electric version of this car. I mean, it's strictly speaking a little bit different, but it's effectively the full electric version of the XC90. And I certainly think we could make that work without too much compromise. But I wasn't ready for the family hauler to be full electric yet. I 100% believe that I should have years ago gotten full electric for myself. I haven't, for several different reasons, but for the family hauler, I didn't want it to be full electric yet. And I stand by that for now. Mm. I could make a strong argument about how wrong I am. So I'm not, you know, this is a weak opinion held loosely. Right, exactly. It's a weak opinion held loosely, I'll be the first to tell you. But certainly for sticking our toe in the water, the plug-in hybrid has been excellent. And I'm really, really happy with it. The qualms I have with the car are, well, let me ask you guys, if you were to just hazard a guess, what do you think my biggest complaint about the car is?
Because I can name it.
Close.
Oh, I was going to say the transmission.
No. Well, there is no transmission 90% of the time we drive it. No, it's software. The software is not great. And it's Google's Android Automotive. Now, maybe it's Volvo's application thereof. I've never had an Android Automotive car before.
Yeah, Android Automotive is a perfectly solid foundation. It's all the crap that the manufacturers put on top of it that often has bugs.
Yeah, anyway, and it's,
that's what I meant by infotainment. How am I close? I'm exactly right. It's infotainment. That's the term of art for the thing you're describing. It's the software that runs on the middle things.
I can't put my... Well, there are times that it's something at a lower level than the infotainment. 90% of my complaints, you're exactly right. It's the infotainment. But there are occasions, and of course I can't put my finger on one specifically right this second, but there are occasions that it's something that I think is a lower level than that. But definitely most of my complaints are the infotainment. And I actually liked the, I think they called it Sensus, which was the Volvo homegrown thing that predated Android Automotive. I liked it. Most people did not. They've kind of tried to make a faux Sensus on top of Android Automotive, and it's all right. But I just don't love the way some of it works. And some silly things have been regressions. So a great example of this is, I don't particularly care for the radio in any capacity. Erin loves listening to the radio in the car, and she really has come to like SiriusXM. And I think we've talked about this in the past, but she likes satellite radio. And Erin is not one to want to pay money for really anything if she can avoid it. She's very frugal, maybe is the word I'm looking for. I think there's an even more complimentary term than that I can't put my finger on, but she doesn't like to spend money frivolously. Meanwhile, that's my specialty, but that's neither here nor there. But and I am a mere apprentice to Marco's expert level at this. But nevertheless,
he snuck in the new version of the big medium format Fuji in there.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't say I own the new version of the medium. There is a new version. I have.
Oh, I thought
version.
You bought the new version. And
oh,
just,
no.
It mentioned it as a off to the side during your story. Okay,
no,
that's a good clarification.
By the way,
Marco did not buy the new one.
No. By the way, remind me to tell you sometime about Long Island Christmas light installation pricing. Oh my God! Anyway,
like paying somebody else to do it.
This is okay. I'm sorry for the derail.
Go for it.
This is a thing. I don't know how long this has been a thing. I'm relatively new to Long Island, but this is a thing. So that there are a lot of houses, especially as you get towards the nicer blocks in town. A lot of houses have professionally installed commercial grade Christmas lights, and you can identify them pretty easily. They're, I believe, it's the C9 sizes. I think it's what they're called, but they're the large lights that are perfectly evenly spaced and are all perfectly aligned to perfectly attach to outline the roof line and all the side lines of a house, and usually some of their landscaping and maybe their driveway and everything. This is so prevalent. I'm shocked. How many houses do this? And first of all, I respect what they're trying to achieve. I do think it kind of goes against the spirit of Christmas lights if they're all perfect and corporate installed by somebody you're paying to put them on your house. Like, I feel like that kind of is against the spirit of Christmas lights, and I prefer a more organic look where somebody just went out there themselves and draped some lights over their bushes. I like that look better. I it's a little more homey, and I think that's kind of what I go for. But anyway, so there's all these just residential homes, and our kids saw this one time and was like, oh my God, we have to have that. How do we do that? So we called around some different places that we saw signs for. You would not believe what this costs.
On Long Island, I'm sure it's thousands.
Yes, which greatly surprised us. And and we were asking for a very basic thing, and it was the quote blew us away. We scaled it back quite a bit. But based on the quote that we got, and based on what everyone else was charging for the same thing, and based on what everyone else seems to be doing to their houses, I think there are at least 15 houses within a few blocks of here that have spent over $5,000, possibly over $10,000 for their Christmas light installation. And that's just for the year. That's just for this year.
Don't forget about the electricity.
Believe me.
Well, if they're LEDs, it might not be that bad.
That's nothing compared to, if you're paying $5,000 or $10,000 for your light installations every year, the electricity is not going to matter at all.
I think you could compete with that if you left them on all the time. But yeah, with LEDs, hopefully it's not that much.
It's shocking to me that people would pay $5,000 or $10,000 to decorate their house for three weeks.
You see how it works, because you just got done saying how you think it's not to your taste, but then also you're looked into paying for some because the neighbors did it. That's how it works. The neighbors have the lights, and you want to have the lights, and just keeping up with the Joneses, and it's happening to you too. Because why did you even agree? Just because Adam wanted it, and you're like, okay, well, I don't like it, but Adam wants it, so we'll do it.
Yeah, I figure we'd try it for a year, and then whoa. So
you could have hung them yourself. That's the old way. I solved this by just not doing lights at all. But when I was a kid, my dad and I did lights. We hung them ourselves, and it was dangerous and stupid. And that's the Christmas spirit.
Yeah, but these are somewhat involved to do yourself, because it's one of those to get the perfect alignment. Each light has its own bracket. It isn't you're not just stapling a couple.
I
of staples
understand.
To the wires.
I agree with you. I don't like that look. I when I'm hanging them, I say you have nails stuck into the eaves of your house, and you hang wires over the nails, and nothing is evenly spaced, and it's very organic.
Yeah, that I prefer that look, but there are a lot of people who prefer this look, and I don't know. I once I learned how much it costs, it kind of ruined it for me. Now I'm just kind of oh my God, those people wasted so anyway, all this is to say that, believe me, Casey, there are people who are way better at wasting money than either of us.
You could put a projector on your lawn, Marco, and have it project lights onto your house. Those things where they take things onto surface. They won't be as bright as the neighbor's lights, but you can have any configuration you want, and it's just one little projector.
Oh my God.
So anyways, Erin doesn't really love spending money if she can avoid it, which is great because I'm very good at it. And so she really likes SiriusXM. And I was starting to say before we got a little sidetracked that one of the things that's worse about this new version of Census, if they're even calling it that now, is that on her old car, when you looked at the list of channels in SiriusXM, if you're trying to flip to like a different channel, it would show you what the currently playing song was on each channel. So like on this list, it would say, you know, hits, whatever is playing Justin Bieber and hit then, you know, 90s on nine is playing so-and-so and zeros on zero is playing such and such. And it would show you whatever's playing on each thing. And it doesn't do that on this version of the software. And to John's earlier point, I believe that is Volvo. I don't think that's Android or excuse me. I don't think that's Google at all. That's Volvo's work. And it's silly things like that that are frustrating. And oftentimes there'll be little bugs and little quirks that, and every great once in a while, we'll have to do a hard reset on the infotainment, which takes down like everything, including the HVAC. So we can be hurtling down the road and have to pull a Marco in his Model S and have to reboot the center console. This has only happened a handful of times in 6 months, but every time it does, it's infuriating. And I can't tell if that's 100% Volvo, if it's 100% Google, or in all likelihood a combination thereof, but that drives me nuts. It's just the software is the issue on this car. And it's not bad enough that I would say don't buy one. I really do love this car, but it's the software. Oh, another great example. This hasn't happened in a while, actually. But when we first got the car, I don't know if it was where we had things stored in the garage or something like that. We have a fairly spacious garage, actually. But Erin would go backing into the garage, and it was not infrequent for the car to panic stop. And understandably, that drove her up a fucking wall, because every time it happened, it's intense. You know, you're granted she's not bombing into the garage. We back in because we're adults and that's what adults should do. And we back into the garage. And so she's not driving at 15 miles an hour into the garage in reverse, but she's going quick enough that if you get this thing panic stopping, it's all of a sudden, you know, it's stopped. You're going from moving to dead. And 90%, or maybe not 90% of the time, but a lot of the time she has kids in the car, and it scares the piss out of the kids too.
Of course.
And so we rearranged a couple of things we had in the garage that really were not that close to the car, but were close enough that I think it might have been setting this off. But like, that's a software thing.
Disable that?
You probably could, but I don't think you can permanently, you know, short of like, you know, coding the car.
It's like the proximity things, like when, you know, my wife got her new car. It's the first car we had with any of these proximity auto stop thingies. And we haven't had the auto stop thingy, but we did have like the beepy things that yell at you if you get too close to something, or yell at you when you're changing lanes with your blind spot. And the proximity ones in particular, at least in this car, there's a very prominent actual physical button on the dashboard that you can hit to turn that feature on and off. So what you do is when you're pulling into the garage, you hit the proximity thing off. I tell her, is that she has it off by default. I tell her, turn it on when you're parking. So if you know you're getting close to some stuff.
But
in Aaron's case, I would say turn it off when you're back into the garage. Even if it comes on as soon as you start the car, like that's what you want. So you should check to see if there's a way to turn off. I mean, your problem, it's not the proximity sensing. It's the emergency stopping that you don't like.
And right.
Volvo being Volvo may not let you turn that off, but you should double check.
Exactly. I mean, I think it was a software thing. And I think by rearranging some things in the garage, it has made a big difference. But when it does happen, it's happened with me in the car a couple times. I don't get driven up a wall by it, but unquestionably, it's unsettling. And that's being generous. Like, it's very unsettling to the point that it's almost scary. And that's as a passenger, much less as a driver.
Does it beep at you too, besides just emergency stopping?
Well, it'll beep, 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 beep. And then it'll like slam on the brakes and like, sound some sort of alarm or something like that. Ryan Booker in the chat is saying that was a bug. I think Polestar used to do the same thing backing into our driveway if there was a blade of grass in the way. as soon as you go into the reverse gear, you can just turn it off, but you have to do it every time. And that I believe it corroborates.
Do you have to go through menus on the touchscreen to turn it off?
I don't recall, to be honest with you, but it's not great in that regard. But again, it's partially our work, potentially partially Volvo's work.
So Volvo, again, being Volvo and being very safety focused, I can see how they might turn a lot of these things on by default. But Honda trying to do the right thing in its interiors with both the proximity sensor and also the auto stop start. The proximity sensor, again, a prominent button directly on the dashboard dedicated to this. Just turning the proximity on and off, and it defaults to on, but then you can turn it off, or I think you can set it to default off, and then you can turn it on. But then the auto stop start, has to default to on for them to get the good EPA, like, mileage rating, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So it always turns on, but it's right by, like, the gear shift lever, like the auto stop start button. And there is an $80 thing, as I think I mentioned when she got this car, there is an $80 thing you can buy and shove inside your dashboard that will turn it off by default. But Honda's trying to say, look, we know which features of our car are annoying, and we will give you ways to defeat them that are as convenient as possible. Very prominently located, easy to reach, easy to see. The auto stop start thing has a gigantic dedicated badge on the LCD instrument cluster, so you always know when it's on and off. It never goes away. It's like the most important thing on the display besides like the amount of fuel you have and your speed. But they have to turn it on by default for safety reasons. So Volvo is not really meeting you halfway about knowing which things are annoying. I think they probably just think this emergency stopping thing is going to save your life someday. And you're like, I'm just trying to back into the garage.
Yeah. The other nice thing about having a plug-in hybrid is that even though the car is parked in a garage with garage door closed overnight, and even though you two, particularly John, seem to think that we live effectively on the equator because we are south of, I don't know, Philadelphia. As it turns out, it does actually get cold here by any reasonable definition. And so,
but not cold enough that your water heater isn't in your garage.
You can't help yourself, can you? Anyway, the point is...
It's 15 degrees here, okay? My water heater is not in my garage.
Well, at least mine isn't outside like Jason's. Anyway,
it's 24 degrees here, and my water heater is currently air conditioning in my garage.
Well, it's 28 here, thank you very much. So it's not like it's that friggin' different.
That's tropical.
Anyway... Jesus Christ, I quit. Anyway, so the point is, in the mornings, when it got properly cold here, which, again, happens more often than you two, John, think, I would oftentimes, like, pull Erin's car out before the kids and her got in it because she drives them to school. I would pull her car out maybe 5 or 10 minutes before they were going to leave so the kids don't have to get into a freezing cold car, and Erin, too, but particularly the kids. And with this... If the car isn't plugged in, you can only run the electric, like, preheat or pre-cool for 3 minutes, and then it turns itself off, probably because the battery is so darn small. But if the car is plugged in, you can run it for a solid 30 minutes. And so anytime within 30 minutes of them needing to leave in the morning, I can just flip that bad boy on from my phone, and it's just perfect in there by the time she gets in and unplugs it, which is great. So, again, there's a lot to be said for battery electric or plug-in hybrid cars. I'm sure there's other things I'm not thinking of that I could say about this, but I got to tell you, if you're in a situation where most of your driving happens within the range of the battery on your plug-in hybrid, but you still want to be able to drive 200, 300, 400, 500 miles without having to stop for 45 minutes at a clip, then I got to tell you, I am really happy with our plug-in hybrid. And I really do think that my next car will be full-on battery electric, and that will actually probably make some very interesting changes in the way Erin and I drive our cars, because right now it is very clear that I have my car and she has hers because she can't drive a stick. And once I get a battery electric, when that goes away and there are only two pedals, I'm very curious to see how we split the duty of our cars. You know, will she, generally speaking, take quote unquote mine when she's doing basic stuff around town because she's not going to want to haul the, I think it's like 5,000, 5,500, 6,000 pound car in order to do stuff? Huh. Or will she just take hers because she's more comfortable?
How much do you think your EV is going to weigh?
I was going to say,
get one of those 3,000 pound EVs?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I forget about how much EVs weigh.
You make a very good point.
Even when they're not SUVs, they're all heavy.
Yeah.
that is very true. You're right about that. But you still take my point, though.
Yes.
I mean, whatever.
Yeah, smaller dimensions would maybe be better also around town for parking and stuff.
Exactly. So, I mean, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'm not currently in the market for a car. And I really do love my car. And I know I'm going to desperately miss having a stick whenever I get something different. But I am really, really happy with her plug-in hybrid. And you know, some quibbles here and there for sure, but I'm really, really glad this is where we ended up. And it may come a time, I presume there will come a time, that we get both of us full-on electric cars, and I'll say to Marco, you know what, Marco, you were right, we could have done it for that 2024 that we leased. But sitting here now to get our foot in the water, I'm really, really happy with it. And if you have this situation where, you know, you work from home or your commute is very, very, very short. I mean, when I was working outside the home, my commute was like 3 miles. So if you're in the situation where you're not driving a whole ton every day, and yet you still want to be able to drive far if you so desire, plug-in hybrid, man, it's great.
Oh, my God. You're, okay, I can't wait. Okay, first of all, plug-in hybrids are great for a lot of people. That being said, once you actually live with a full EV, you're going to realize how it was so not a big deal the way you thought it would be.
Like, I'm sure you're right. I don't doubt it.
Long trips. Like, because, look, I get range anxiety. I get, trying to avoid EV charging infrastructure because it's unfamiliar and scary. Like, I get that. And yes, there are downsides for certain use cases for EVs, but, like, it's so much less of a big deal than people think it will be to take EVs on long trips before they own them. Once you own one and live with it and actually do it, you're like, oh, that's fine. Like, it's not like it isn't better in every way, but it's better in a lot of ways. And it's not that much worse than you think it'll be in the few ways it is worse. So, like, it's not a big deal. But in the meantime, plug-in hybrids are a good, like, transitional option. And so I'm glad you're enjoying it. I'm glad it's working as kind of, training wheels into the world of electric. And I'm glad you're able to enjoy, like, some of those benefits of electric-only use or electric primary use in the meantime. So that's great.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more that, this is training wheels at the moment. And the funny thing about this is that if I'm honest with you two, there are definitely times that Aaron's prior XC90, the pure gasoline XC90, there are definitely some multi-hundred mile trips we went on with that car. But generally speaking, in an average year, the longest trip that Aaron's car made and this one will make is 140 miles, which is well within the range of now that's one way, mind you. So what is that? About 300 miles round trip, which is still almost, I would say most electric cars, jump in Marco, but most electric cars have roundabouts of 250 to 300 mile range. So even round trip, we could probably do it in one charge if we really needed to. But generally speaking, her car does not go far. So that's even more credence that I'm full of it. And Marco's right that we should just have a full battery electric.
You're currently
for Aaron.
Using an EV with 35 miles of range. You realize that's your is able to serve all of your needs with an EV with 35 miles of range. It just happens to weigh 5,500 pounds.
I agree. You're not wrong. That being said, we are going on a longer trip this upcoming summer, which is 320 miles each way. But that doesn't mean we couldn't charge when we're there. And it's going to be a week-long trip. So, presumably, even if we were plugged into a standard 110-volt outlet, I would assume in the span of literally a week, we would be able to top that thing up. So I do agree
with
you.
But you would never do that because fast charging is really easy.
Also fair. But my point is that, like, it could happen. I'm not trying to say that it is an impossibility for us. It's just something that I certainly wasn't comfortable with. And if I wasn't comfortable with it, there is no chance that Aaron would be comfortable with it. And actually, John is writing something in our internal show notes as we speak, which reminded me of the one thing I meant to say, which I've forgotten to say. Aaron, the other day, when it started to get cold by our standards, which at this point I will concede is not cold by Northeastern standards. This was like maybe a month ago. Aaron gets in the car and is like, is something wrong with my car? And I was like, oh God, what? Why? She said, well, it's not saying I have 30 plus miles range. It says like 28, 29, 27, something like that. I forget what it was. And I was like, huh. And then I stepped outside. Oh. Yep, that's a thing. She said, what? And she said, what are you talking about? I was like, oh yeah, it's cold outside. Yeah. Well, the battery doesn't work as well as it's cold when it's cold. What? Now, let me be clear. Erin is not a dumb woman. I would say she's brighter than me in almost every capacity, but she's not as knowledgeable as me about cars and that sort of thing. And she had no idea that she would take a hit for range during the winter. And yeah, the 32-ish miles that we were getting in the summer, it's now like 27-ish usually when we pull out of the garage in the morning.
Yeah, but again, like, yes, that is like a thing that happens, but that's less about like inherent shortcomings of EVs and more just about lack of familiarity. Like I always think,
yeah, I agree.
There was that one blog post that we linked to 1,000 years ago from like, it was like written from the perspective of somebody who's just discovering gas cars for the first time.
Oh yes. That
EVs.
Was very good. I forget. I don't think we could find it, but that was very good.
It up. But yeah, but it was like, I love that perspective because it's like a lot of what people consider downsides of EVs are not considering similar downsides of gas cars, or, you know, it's like it's comparing it against like a perfect ideal that doesn't exist, rather than looking at what actually is. You know, there's downsides with everything, and there's different trade-offs. You know, like part of the reason why EVs have to, you know, make their own heat in the winter, which is somewhat inefficient, and uses more range, is because there isn't a giant inefficient heat reaction happening as it operates to drive itself forward the way it is in gas. Like, gas cars can heat the cabin for basically for free because there is just so much waste heat coming right. out of the
exactly.
engine.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you're like, okay, well, that's great. That's free. But then you're like, well, you mean we're wasting all of that energy all the rest of the time? And huh, it's heating up the world all yeah. the rest of the time?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that isn't without downside either, you know? So, like, there is, you know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, just, you know, gas car, you know, bias in our minds, because it's like that's, we've accepted that as normal. We have internalized, like, yeah, well, this is just how, quote, normal cars operate. So then when EVs come around, like, we see all the differences without realizing, like, there's a lot of downsides to gas cars, too.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And again, like, I will never say that EVs are better at everything, but I will say that they are better at most things. and again, like, the ways they are worse are not as much worse for most people as they might think. But in almost every other way, they're better.
Yeah, and again, I think we could absolutely make an EV work, and I say that as though it would be some immense burden.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be. And I intellectually know that, but I just wasn't there yet. And again, if I'm not there yet, I don't think Aaron was either. But I suspect what's going to happen is whenever my car gets replaced, and I don't know if that's tomorrow or 10 years from now, but whenever my car gets replaced, I'll get some sort of full electric car. And once we live with that, I think it'll quickly become very clear to us that, oh, we could make this work and it wouldn't be as burdensome as we fear.
Oh, it'll be better than that. You won't just be making it work. You'll love it. Like, give it like 2 months or less,
yeah.
and you'll be like, oh my God, why do we wait this long?
Well, and that's true, too, because Aaron's car went in full battery mode, either because it's in the quote unquote pure or because we just haven't kicked on the gasoline yet. It's sufficiently quick, but it is not quick. I mean, it is a very heavy car, and it is not a tremendous motor that's driving it. And so it is not fast by any means. It's actually surprisingly peppy once you've got both of them working together, because the gasoline, I believe, only drives the front axle and the battery only drives the rear. But generally speaking, when we drive it, like I said, it's sufficiently quick, but it is not quick. Whereas even slow EVs that I've driven, like my parents have a Chevy, is it Bolt? I always get it Bolt and Volt wrong. I forget which one it is. But whatever one is the one that they were producing up until like a year ago. Maybe it's a Volt. Crap, I don't remember. It doesn't
Molt.
Matter. Anyways, I'm sorry, B or V?
Molt.
Fair. Yeah, it sheds. It sheds all the every couple of seasons. It's very weird. But anyways, whatever their piece of crap Chevy electric is, it is a piece of crap Chevy electric, and yet it's actually delightful. And from 0 to 30 miles an hour, pretty damn fast. You'd be surprised. And that's not a performance car by any stretch of the imagination. So I am looking forward to whenever we get a full battery electric to have, you know, that instant torque and more than just a small helping of it from 0 RPM. John, are you wanting to talk about this winter report card today or another day?
No, that's future after show.
Right. Hello and goodbye, future right. Marco.
Title.
All right, let's do some titles.
You answer my question, Casey. How long is your lease? Stop for the show.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did hear that, and then I got sidetracked. It's 3 years, so it'll be 2027, summer 27.
So your time for some kind of decision is coming up, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sitting here now, I would probably guess that we might just buy this out, which will make Marco very sad, but I want to reevaluate.
Look, Aaron can do what she
comes.
Wants with her car. You got to go EV on your car.
Well, the thing is, we should talk about this another time. I think this could also be an after show, but I don't know what I would buy. A, because I'm cheap and I don't want to spend $60,000 on a car. And B, there's not much that really, really revs my engine right now. and so I don't know what I would buy anyway. Like, and anything that does kind of get me excited is either not the right car for me and or way too much money. As an example, I would love an R1S, CarPlay notwithstanding, but last I looked, they're $100,000 and they're friggin' huge. And I do not need a friggin' huge car, nor do I have the money, nor do I want to spend $100,000 on a truck. So Not for me, but I don't know what I would buy.
That's one of the other things that is currently in favor of hybrids. They're getting better about making them less terrible and annoying, and you can get one at a reasonable price in lots of different forms. And that is unfortunately still not the case with EVs because the batteries are so darn expensive. We need a cost breakthrough on batteries.
Yeah,
really to break that ceiling. It's not like they're refusing to. Or, well, what they are refusing to do is make the 35-mile range EV that would actually be cheaper, but no one in America would buy. So they all have to have 300 miles of range. And a 300-mile range battery costs a certain amount. That's going to put a floor on the prices of all these EVs. Casey doesn't want to pay that floor, neither do I. So we're out here in potentially hybrid land. But not me. Mine are just plain gas cars still.
Anyway,
I got two of them for the price of Casey's car, and three of them for the price of Marco's car.
Well, how much was Civic, like 25 and the Accord like
20? So it was like 30 and the other ones were all, both under 25.
Oh, then yes, you are correct. Actually, you both of yours combined were not that far away from my Golf R, believe it or not, because that was 40, I think, like on the nose or damn near on the nose. And that was out the door tax title tag. It was like 40. So anyway, titles, I said Blended Human. It was a one-off, but it was kind of funny. I also liked, and I did suggest Abandoned and Lonely, but I don't remember what it was about at this point.
You've already forgotten.
Yep. But I thought it was good.
I like hybrid accent. I like That Being Said waveform. If you hyphenate That Being Said.
I like Master Plan to take over the world.txt, although I don't really like the file name extension. I would just take off the file name extension and just say Master Plan to take over the world.
I could do that. I could do any of them, to be honest.
Master Plan should be two words.
It is, yeah. I was looking it up just to confirm that. I think sometimes there's a stylized version where it's together, but let me see if I can support that with anything. Hang on. Oh, there's a band called Master Plan. It's a German power metal band.
Nine.
See, Apple Dictionary has it as two words.
Do you want to just do that? Two words,
hang on,
no text?
Check Merriam-Webster. Merriam-Webster says two words. Let's go with two words.
Are you okay with that, Marco?
Yeah.
So master space. Oh, right. Master space plan to take over the capital W world. No. Yep. .txt.
Mm-hmm.
All right, give me a second to clear out some of the stuff that I put in the robot because we didn't end up using some of our show notes.
Oh, we're doing that now.
I always try to clear out the stuff we don't use, but I usually fail. So, give me a sec. We're just gonna actually. We can just cut off the live people at this point, right?
Yeah.
I need to hear you editing the document.
Yeah, exactly. When are we live next? New Year, right?
Second, I think. Let me see. Thursday, January 2nd, normal time.
Wait.
No, here we go. Here we go.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm going to have trouble with that.
We collectively moved it to that position in the past.
I know.
It's not. All right, well, just let us know.
Let me see what I can. I might have to be the third. Can it be the third?
It can be.
Depending on time.
You'll be a bit of a rush on the edit.
That's fine. Yeah, if it can be the third, that would be great.
Well, hold on.
If we might actually be here. I think it needs to be the third.
I can't do the third, unless we're doing daytime.
Shit. All right, we'll work it out.
I could, but I'm gonna be real friggin' cranky about it, but I can do it if I absolutely have to.
I'm not gonna be here this second. I'm gonna be upstate still.
Let's work it out in the after show, please.
Yep. All right.
Goodbye, live people. We'll talk to you sometime in the new year. And everyone, tell John happy birthday on New Year's Eve. He's turning 50.
Yeah, big deal. He doesn't. He no gifts, no party.
Loves it when I say this. Yeah, he loves it when I say this.
Yeah, but big deal. All right. Bye, everybody. Have a happy Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, whatever you want to celebrate or nothing, whatever you want to do. Happy that, and we'll see you next year.